Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings today, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way today. Indiana and North Carolina going to the polls. It should be an interesting time. A very interesting time, as the old Chinese curse, I guess. Well, we'll see what happens. By the way, Louise and I are semi-pseudo-grandparents. Gusolini, our crazed Canadian goose that lives on our back dock, and his wife, I guess, with Canadian geese. They seem to be monogamous, at least for the season, lives on the dock next to us on Pam, our neighbor's dock. And she's been sitting on eggs for months, and Gusolini's been chasing us off every time we try to get out there. And they now have five babies floating around. So for the moment, the five little fluffy yellow things, we'll try to get a picture up on our website. But also the eagles and the hawks are starting to hang around. And, little baby geese, sometimes a.k.a. duck or eagle food or hawk food. In any case, thought you'd find that interesting. Because I talk about Gusolini. In fact, I opened my book, Cracking the Code, with a chapter, the story of Gusolini and what he taught me about communication. Speaking of communication, a lot going on with regard to the election and the setup for the election and the issue of vote fraud and electronic voting and purging and caging and all these other things. And there's been some hysterical emails flying around, and I think also some, hey, let's calm down and look at this. Bev Harris is with us with blackboxvoting.org. Bev, one of the original real pioneers in this field, looking into the whole issue of black box voting. I wrote an article mentioning Bev back in 2002, I think, or 2003, and Bev was already well into this at that time. And Bev Harris, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you again.
Great to have you back on the show, Bev. It looks like Indiana is being caged email seems to have originated from black box voting, and the correction of, no, it wasn't deleted, it was changed, seats seems to have originated from black box voting. Tell us what's going on here in Indiana that you know about, and what this, portends for the general election.
Well, first, we didn't say, oh, my God, it's been
purged. No, you didn't. Yeah.
Well, we did say, though, and this remains true, that according to the Secretary of State's own document, 1.1 million voter registrations have been canceled.
Right.
Now, even election officials who looked at this said canceled would appear to mean canceled. But the Secretary, after we looked at the old EAC numbers, we realized that those numbers just didn't jive and really couldn't be possible. There were more, some counties had everybody, 100% of the rolls. But what is almost equally disturbing is the Secretary of State is saying, well, it doesn't mean they were canceled. The 1.1 million, and this is out of 4 million, or changed. Well, that would be kind of curious if it was evenly spread and dispersed across the state, but it's concentrated into certain counties, and it really is a concern. For example, Monroe County, which has Bloomington, which is a university town, 85% of the voter registrations were changed.
Now, does that mean that these are independents re-registering as Democrats? Although I don't think you have to re-register in Indiana.
Well, Indiana doesn't have, from what I understand, Indiana is one of the states where there is kind of no such thing as registering as a Democrat or a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So you can vote whether, you're not,
right, it's
you're
open
not
primary.
Tagged to something in the primary. Now, that's a good point you bring up, though, because in Florida, we have an internal email that we posted last year where, they had somebody apparently enter the system in the middle of the night and all kinds of voter registrations were changed from Democrat to Republican.
Right.
And, of course, in states where that is relevant to the voting in the primary, that would disenfranchise people. What I'm concerned about in Indiana is typos and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, could it be that this is what they were trying to clean up? But what you had were the registrars of voting in several counties just getting very enthusiastic and saying, let's just make sure that these are, for example, the one thing that comes to mind is going to 9-digit zips instead of 5-digit zips, you know, just going through and making sure that everything is right and people are in the right district and that kind of thing.
Well, if you look at Porter County, it had 124,000 changes out of 100,000 votes.
Which means that some of them were changed more than once.
Right. So obviously some were changed more than once, or there was a subset that was changed over and over.
Right.
But the issue here is, you see, it has to do with citizen controls. If we want a system that we can trust, we have to have the information. And we don't want somebody just saying, oh, you know, la, 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 we have 1.1 million people, one quarter of the rolls that are canceled. Oh, no, cancel doesn't mean canceled. Cancel means change. Oh, we don't know what the changes were. And I want to point out one other thing here that's a protective concern. Indiana just installed a voting ID requirement in which you have to bring a government issued identification, and it has to match the data in the registration database.
Right.
Now, if I go in there and I just introduce typos into the database, it's not going to find you, and your ID isn't going to match.
For example, you are, I believe, probably legally Beverly Harris.
Right.
And if you registered as Bev Harris and you show up with ID that says Beverly Harris, then they could, under the new Supreme Court ruling, they could say, I'm sorry, your legal ID, your driver's license, does not match the way you're registered, and
that
therefore you
happened.
Cannot vote.
In some states, although in Indiana they are saying it does not need to be an exact match, and they will accept nicknames.
Okay.
But let me give you another example. Suppose the V in Bev is just changed to N, and I become Ben Harris.
Right.
You know, the system, then it really becomes an issue whether I can vote or not. I may not be able to vote if it says Ben Harris.
Right. Is there, I know some states have outsourced this kind of thing to private corporations, Florida and Texas, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that the case in Indiana, or is this entirely being done within the
actually don't
the
know what
bureaucracy?
The data entry is in Indiana. I have received emails from people who have been hired as temps to do the data entry,
mm-hmm.
both in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, and in Denver, Colorado. And, you know, it really is a huge challenge. They're having an awful time even getting the people entered onto the rolls in a lot of these places.
Mm-hmm.
So they're bringing in lots of temps. One of the temps mentioned to me that there was a lot of training difficulties where they would have all kinds of quality control problems. Oh, this code doesn't mean that code, you know, and so forth.
Yeah.
This is just
these may, though, just be the growing pains.
Yeah,
the growing pains that are the consequence of these massive numbers of people who are being brought into this program, both by the Clinton campaign and apparently particularly by the Obama campaign, and the large numbers of people changing registration.
Well, and it isn't even just that. They're transferring old systems into a new system, and some of that is requiring data entry because it doesn't import
right.
in.
So what's the big picture here, Bev? Is there any evidence of something that we should be concerned about in Indiana or anywhere else in the country at this particular point in time, or is this more just, hey, you know, stuff is happening, we should keep an eye on it, there needs to be more transparency?
Oh, well, we should be concerned about the system as long as votes are counted in secret by government insiders. That's a transfer of power.
Right.
You see, anytime you have votes counted inside a computer, and the you cannot secure a computer from its own admin. So
right.
that what
its own administrator.
Means, yeah. You know, it's not possible. So the government insider who controls that computer system or controls the data entry has control over the counting of the votes, and the citizens don't and can't see it.
And in many cases, those government insiders, like with Blackwell in Ohio, are partisans.
Oh, my goodness, yes. The Secretary of State of Indiana made a horrible statement that's in a tape recording in a statement in Monroe County lately. He said, you know, it had to do with black people are still slaves to the Democratic Party and so forth.
Oh, my.
You know, and
is this a Republican?
Very partisan individual. You know, so it isn't rare that Catherine Harris, Secretary of State is the one that has direct access to a lot of these databases and through their employees as well.
Sure.
So, you know, as long as what it is we shouldn't be in a position of saying, well, prove to us that there was fraud and then I'll be concerned. Instead, we should say, look, as long as insiders in the government are counting our vote in secret, we need to be concerned. We need to get it back out in the open.
So and as long as private corporations own the machines or claim to own the or own the software and it's entirely proprietary, we've got a big problem. Part of our commons has been privatized. The most important part of our commons, our vote.
Sure.
So, Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org. You can read about it over there. Bev, thanks a lot for the
thank
for
you
the
very
update.
Much.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Yeah, thank you. 16 minutes past the hour. Want to get into some of the issues around the campaign today and also, you know, what's going on? What's the state of America, particularly for young people as they're coming into the, many of them, for the, this their first election? 16 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Time to get out there and, particularly if you're in Indiana or North Carolina, get out there and vote today. Well, a lot of...
take off your coat.
Yeah. Iowa was the big one.
Real slow.
And New Hampshire was the big one. This is from Bill in Portland, Maine, by the way, over at the Daily Kos. Michigan was supposed to be the big one, but state party officials interfered and made it a win. And Nevada and South Carolina were the big ones. Florida played Michigan's game and ended up with another win. And Super Tuesday, baby, now that was the big one. The Potomac primary, the real big one. And Texas and Ohio were the biggest big ones of all. So Pennsylvania came along, it wasn't just the big one, it was the big one. See, size matters, you know. Now Indiana, North Carolina, the biggest big ones of all in Biggin Land. Yeah, the reality here, there's actually, after this primary, today's primaries, there'll only be 217 delegates left to fight over. Now, all of that said, there's something that really concerns me. Hopefully within the next 10 minutes or so, we'll have a link up at tomhartman.com, but there is a photo of this, I believe, over at Carolyn Kay's website at makethemaccountable.com. And this is this point that I've made on the program a number of times over, and we've had many conversations about this, you know, which is more pernicious, which is more destructive in the United States, sexism or racism? And it's just a terrible thing that we even have to ask the question. But Louise called this morning to the store just to confirm it, because I couldn't believe this was actually happening, and called the CNBC store in the airport in Washington, D.C., and said, is it true that a Hillary Nutcracker doll is being sold in your store? And they said, yeah. And, in fact, you know, shortly we will have a link to the how to contact CNBC information on this. As I said, if you want to see the photo of it, you can go over to makethemaccountable.com. And it's a and hopefully soon we'll have that up on our website. We're working on it right now. But the doll says at the very top, is America ready for this nutcracker? This is the packaging. And then there's Hillary Clinton. And it says, stainless steel thighs, cracks toughest nuts. Now, can you imagine the outcry, the outraged outcry, if this had been a Barack Obama, how many pieces of watermelon can he eat, or some other god-awful racial stereotype doll that was being sold? It would, you know, it would explode in their faces. But a sexist stereotype, just kind of, I guess it's a joke. Well, frankly, I don't think it's a joke. I think this is worse than in bad taste. And it's also evidence of the fact that in America we tolerate sexism in ways that we don't tolerate racism, and all the more the tragedy. And it's the sort of thing that, and this transcends the issue of whether you support Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, frankly. This is a commentary on America, on where we're at and where we're going and what kind of nation we're going to be. And an important commentary, I think. And, if, for example, Bill Clinton being used by Rush Limbaugh. Well, here's it started out, George Stephanopoulos talking with Hillary Clinton about Limbaugh.
Rush Limbaugh is asking Republicans to come out and vote for you in order to divide the party.
He's always had a crush on me.
See, I mean, that was a great comeback on the senator's part. Well, yeah, Limbaugh's always had a crush on me, but then...
I think she's just saying this because, actually, this the explanation for this is, to me...
Now, this Limbaugh calling into Fox News to tell this story.
Hey, I understand now why Bill Clinton hit on my date.
Hit on his date, as Keith Olbermann pointed out last night. Rush, they're called escorts.
About a year ago at the Kobe Club in New York, I was minding my own business and Clinton came in. And the short version is he used the mayor of Los Angeles to distract me while hitting on my date. So I figure he thinks it must be true, too.
I can't believe that, Rush. I find that impossible to believe.
Martha, do you want the rhyme and read? I'll tell you that I'll give you. He came over three or four times. He had Ron Burkle with him and the mayor of Los Angeles, who I thought was either the shoeshine guy or a Secret Service agent. And he was going on and on and on about how he loved me, had to talk to me. And after a minute of talking to the mayor of L.A., I glanced to my left and Bill Clinton's face is 3 inches away from my date.
And see, there's really two things here. One, the shoeshine boy comment about Mayor Villagrosa. And I apologize for mispronouncing his name. He's been a guest on this program. There's that. I mean, you know, which we pointed out yesterday. This is just outrageous that Limbaugh is saying that. But beyond that, now he's using this as an opportunity to drag up this canard of Bill Clinton as sexual predator, essentially, and hoping that that's going to get some traction. So, you know, Bill Clinton as Reverend Wright. In other words, Bill Clinton as the millstone around the neck of Hillary Clinton. At the same time, that Limbaugh is out there telling all of his minions, all of his ditto heads, to get out there and vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, it at a certain point, it gets downright bizarre. So it's going to be very interesting to see how all this plays out in the election, and particularly in Indiana, which has an open primary, much like Michigan, which has a long history of Republicans playing in the Democratic sandbox and doing so to the disadvantage of the Democrats. Want to get into just very briefly some of this new analysis, the Center for American Progress, of where the millennials, where the youngest generation coming of age right now is at economically, what that may have to do with the election right after this.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Is it going to be the showdown at the OK Corral? I realize it's the wrong music, but close enough. Westerns are Westerns, right? Is this the day? Is this the day? Is this going to be the end of the race, or is this just another step along the path? We will see. I just wanted to very quickly share with you this information from the Center for American Progress, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here at 866-303-2270. Also, you can drop into our live chat room. Go over to TomHartmann.com and click live chat, and there's also a link there from the Tom Hartmann page over at AirAmerica.com. The study is called the Economic State of Young America, and they're looking at people in the under 35 cohort, principally 25 to 34. Incomes are declining between the 75 and 2005, basically from Reagan till today. And Jimmy Carter, actually, during the last couple of years of his presidency, particularly with all the Republicans in Congress, there was all this, deregulation was the rage. And it set the stage for what Reagan did. And then Reagan just put it on steroids. And then Reagan went on, of course, declared war against working people in the United States by breaking PATCO and saying that, hey, we can bust unions, you can too. And we went from 25% of the American workforce being unionized to now 7% of the private workforce in the United States, the non-governmental workforce is unionized. Anyhow, between 75 and 2005, typical earnings for young men, 25-54, with only a high school diploma, fell by 29%. Women, 10% during that time in that age group. Typical earnings for young workers with some college fell 21% for men, 6% for women. Average college graduate has nearly $20,000 in debt. Average credit card debt has increased 47% between 1989 and 2004 among 25 to 34-year-olds and 11% among 18 to 24-year-olds. People are more in debt. Higher rent is absorbing more of their income. In 2006, it was a quarter of their total income. It used to be 22% back in 1980. And this progressive generation, the millennials, 57% say that they are that health insurance should come from the government. 87% say they think the government should spend more money on health care, even if it requires a tax increase to pay for it. And 95% of the millennial generation think education spending should be increased, even if a tax increase is required to pay for it. Is America on the verge of moving in the direction of Denmark? And what does the direction of Denmark mean? Well, we will be broadcasting this show live from Danish Radio's studios in Copenhagen in about 5 weeks, I think it is. We'll be over there. So going from the worst place on earth, Darfur, to the happiest place on earth, Copenhagen, should be interesting. Allison in Evansville, Indiana.
Hi.
Allison, what's going on in Indiana today?
I just wanted to let you know, something weird happened. My husband went to vote, and he had registered at the BMV, mm-hmm. and he took a receipt with him, and they wouldn't let him vote. They said that he was not on their list.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was there somebody similar to him or same address or anything like that, or he just didn't exist?
The first time he voted in the county.
Oh, interesting.
So he had to register, and he had his receipt, and it says, you know, take the receipt to your polling place on election day. It indicates that you applied to register, and this receipt will serve as proof that you did apply and will permit you to vote on election day.
How long ago did he do this?
He did it, has to be, I think, 29 days, and he did it on April 4th.
So it was more than 29 days out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when he presented his receipt, did they say, here's a provisional ballot or something like that?
Yeah, they gave him a provisional ballot. And it was, you know, they put it in an envelope. And on the outside it said, they will decide if the vote counts.
Right. Yeah, provisional ballots more often than not are essentially placebo ballots. But that's very interesting. Allison, thanks for the heads up. It'll be interesting to hear from our other listeners in Indiana what their experiences are. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. Yeah. Laird in Eureka, California, listening on KGUA. Hey, Laird, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First time listener, but I often call. Bad joke, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Laird. I was trying to figure that one out.
You know, many of the questions you ask on the show have a very general two-word answer to them. And the two words are truth and education. Are we together so far?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm calling about education today. I live in California. Last week, several dozen students in Eureka High School walked out of school in protest because their administration told them they were cutting extracurricular activities. They were cutting music, sports, and art. Now, the reason I'm calling is because the budget here in California gets signed next week. And I would like everybody, even from other states, if it's possible, because this is not just California's problem.
Mm-hmm.
We're dumbing down our kids.
Yeah.
There's an insidious problem here besides the kids themselves. And that is that by taking away these elective subjects, which traditionally get good grades, we are dumbing down the GPA average in this state.
No, Laird, I absolutely agree with you, and this is an important issue, education, and the bottom line is that we need to elevate education to the top, or near the top, I mean, right up there with healthcare, of the agenda. We talk about investing in the infrastructure of bridges and roads. If we don't invest in the infrastructure, the intellectual infrastructure of this nation, our youth, And frankly, we should be doing it the way that virtually every industrialized democracy in the world does it, and that is free college education for anybody who can qualify. And let's stop having a limit on the number of people who can get into medical school. so that, you know, to keep doctors' salaries up. Let's take that away from the AMA and just say, you know, anybody who wants to become a physician, for example, can. I mean, this is crazy. John in Long Beach, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John.
Hello. How are you today?
Great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. There was a discussion yesterday about the Supreme Court ruling on voter ID for Indiana.
Right.
And they said, are you concerned about that? The person talking was a writer for the Indianapolis Star News. And he said, no. He said, we have had that voter ID in place for a long time. It's
right.
Just that recently, with the Supreme Court ruling, it's still in place. And so it's nothing new to Indiana voters. And I was surprised because I thought this was all going to hit right at election time.
Yeah. There's 26 states altogether that have, you know, variations on this thing.
Okay.
And what's so bizarre about this is that 40 years ago, I think last month, the Supreme Court ruled that I think it was in the state of Georgia, I could be wrong, but it was one of the southern states, that a $1.50 poll tax, which was basically a tax that was used to pay for the cost of running elections, that was the rationale for it. Although the real subtle reality behind it was, you know, any kind of barrier that we can put in the way of people voting, particularly poor people, we're going to do. And 40 years ago, a buck and a half was like, say, $15 or $20 in today's money. That $1.50 poll tax represented an inappropriate burden to people, making it too difficult for them to vote. And this is a huge reversal by the Supreme Court. Now saying, no, this ID thing, this is not a poll tax, and we'll just go along with it. It's wrong. Doug in San Diego. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm just great. You're listening on Cox Cable.
Yeah, because you went off the air here in San Diego, and it really disappoints me. But I'm listening on Cox
the whole
Cable.
The whole station went down in San Diego.
Yeah, it's much clearer on Cox Cable, though, so that's a good thing.
Great.
But here you're once again talking about voter ID, and then you're talking about, with Beth, worried about Democrats and Republicans crossing over primaries, when you don't talk enough about that the states are not validating citizenship when people register to vote and vote. Now that the Supreme Court ruled with voter ID and said that you have to have a voter ID in Indiana, you can have states can have picture ID,
yeah.
This will prevent non-citizens from voting in our elections. Now,
Doug, it's going to prevent a non-problem. It's going to prevent
a
non-problem. You know how many people were prosecuted in the last election cycle?
Can I speak, please?
How many?
Very few. I called
six.
All 50 states. Now, the reason why they don't prosecute is because judges won't find them.
No, they're not prosecuting because it's not happening. You want election fraud? Go look at what happened with the caging of 80,000 people in Florida. Look at the people who are being knocked off the voting rolls because
Tom,
their names are similar to out-of-state felons.
Can I make my point, please?
Go for it.
Okay. They're not validating U.S. citizenship when you register to vote, and they're not making this transparent in the Secretary of State of Elections offices. They can't tell you how they validate that citizenship on that database.
I understand, Doug. I agree with you.
Okay,
I agree with you. It's not happening.
Say,
and the reason it's not happening is because it's not a big deal. Do you really think that somebody who is in this country illegally is going to walk into a government agency, into a polling place, where they know it's a crime, it's a felony to vote if you're not a citizen, where they know it's a crime just to cast a vote?
If they know,
are you serious?
Prosecuted. If they know they're not going to get prosecuted, it's happened in California with John McCain here against Mitt Romney. It happened in Florida with John McCain in Florida. The Hispanic non-citizen vote put them over the edge. They don't validate.
On.
They don't validate. Get the Secretary of State from Indiana on the phone, or North Carolina, or California, and I'll give you $1,000 to any of your charity after you talk to them. And if you're satisfied that they're validating U.S. citizenship when people vote, I'll give you, I'll write that check.
My point, Doug, is it's not necessary. This is not, if you want an issue that has to do with elections, if you want an issue that has to do with the integrity of our elections, here's the issue for you. What about caging? What about the woman who testified before the United States Congress in the Bush administration who said that Tim What's-His-Name, who was working for Karl Rove, was in charge of the caging operation out of Karl Rove's office? What about the throwing hundreds of thousands of people off the voter rolls all across the United States? Not because they're not citizens, but because they're not Republicans.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
For the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It is time for a change in Washington, D.C. You can find out more at teamster.org. Now, at a certain level, a lot of this stuff seems like it is small issue, lowercase s, lowercase I, small issue stuff. For example, the whole Reverend Wright controversy. Stephen Colbert, putting it in context, playing some clips of Sean Hannity, and he refers to Papa Bear, you know, Bill O'Reilly, getting all hysterical about this, and then his commentary.
Well, what kind of judgment allows a sitting senator to attend a church that radical? Why is Barack Obama continuing to go to that church?
He stayed in the church for 20 years. For 20 years. I just don't know how you could sit there for 20 years. Let's say he went to the church 10 years and then left the church. Yeah. I think people would have said, all right, he was showing better judgment.
Exactly. Exactly, says Stephen Colbert, and then he goes on to put it in context.
When you see or hear things that are bad or going on in your church, you get up and you walk out. That's what Catholics like me and Papa Bear and Sean Hannity understand. You leave that church. Unless it's, you know, widespread, decades-long rumors of sexual abuse. In that case, you got to give it time.
But see, the larger issue here is that the whole Reverend Wright thing is about trying to, in the minds of white voters, particularly white racist voters, trying to darken or blacken Barack Obama to make him the African-American candidate. When up until the Reverend Wright thing exploded on the scene, he was not widely perceived as the African-American candidate. He was perceived as a Democratic candidate, an all-American candidate who was running, who happened to have a black father and a white mother. Similarly, the Is America Ready for This Nutcracker doll that is being sold in the airport shops in Washington, D.C. of Hillary Clinton with stainless steel thighs and cracks tough as nuts. This is again, an attempt to cater, just like the Obama right stuff is an attempt to cater to the racist vote. This is an attempt to cater to the misogynist vote. Not just sexist, but misogynist, people who are afraid of and or hate women, you know, particularly men. I mean, this is the battle for the paranoid, fearful white guy vote on both sides, frankly. And I think it's downright tragic. Len in Los Angeles. Hey, Len, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling on that nutcracker issue. Normally, it is outrageous, but with Hillary, she always plays up to those kind of people in the first place, and she turns her back on Democrats anyway. So I don't think there's any point in Democrats getting outraged about it.
Yeah, I don't see her turning her back on Democrats. I see her reaching out for Democrats. And thanks, Len. I'm sorry you're getting awful loud there. But in terms of her making jokes, I mean, what else can you do? It's like, how do you deal with that kind of thing? Humor is a great way to deflect it, but it's got to be a tough one. Rick in Grand Rapids, listening to WTKG. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with the last caller and disagree with you a little there, Tom, because, for instance, in 2006, I voted for Jennifer Granholm and Debbie Stabenow out here in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
voted for another woman for judge, and I voted for a woman in the city county commission, and she and her are friends, and she doesn't care for Hillary. The problem with Hillary is...
But not caring for Hillary is a very different thing from calling her a nutcracker.
But that's the persona, the aura she gives off.
No, it's not.
Well,
When have you ever heard Hillary say or even suggest or imply anything about castrating men? Okay. I hear Tucker Carlson doing this, saying,
Tom,
when I hear her voice, I tighten my legs. I mean, that's... Go ahead, Rick.
I can only give you my perception.
Yeah.
And believe me, I watch MSNBC and like Keith Olbermann a heck of a lot better than I like any of the Fox people. But here's the thing that you and all other progressives better be aware of. Limbaugh was telling people to vote for her. O'Reilly's having a love fest with her. Ann Coulter says she's going to vote for her. There's something up here. Now, it either means that they think she's the weaker candidate, or it means that they see something in her that they like.
No, I'll tell you what it is, Rick. It's that they see her as the weaker candidate. Barack Obama, Carl Wolfson was pointing this out this morning on our local show on KPOJ, and it bears repeating, and I salute Carl for coming to these conclusions, and thank you, Rick, for your comments. And that is that in the election, and Carl's got a master's degree in political science. I mean, he studied this stuff. And in the election of 32, this incredible coalition came together. It was one of the major seismic shifts, tectonic shifts in American politics. This huge coalition came together of young people, people registering as first-time voters. My father's father, who had come from Norway in 1917, was among those people. He was a socialist and voting, registering to vote for Roosevelt. There was this whole huge movement, essentially. Roosevelt built a movement. Reagan built a movement. The conservative movement actually built Reagan, I think would be another way to say it, because they brought him to power. Bobby Kennedy, had he not been assassinated in 68, was building a movement. But arguably the last two movements that we've seen were 1932, or the 30s, throughout the 30s, and 1980. And now Barack Obama is building a movement. And there's no way to deny that. And this is not a slam on Hillary at all. And that movement, frankly, I think is what is intimidating the Reich to the point that you've got Rupert Murdoch and Richard Mellon Scaife and all the people who have traditionally hated not just Democrats, but hated Hillary Clinton as well, try to destroy her, saying, we've got to stop this movement. And the question in my mind, and I think the question in a lot of Democrats' minds, is if Barack Obama is not the nominee, will the movement embrace Hillary Clinton and continue? And frankly, I think the movement is gaining a lot of momentum. I think that the movement has to do with a generational shift. I think it has to do with an awakening. I think it has to do with the kind of extraordinary damage that has been done to the United States by George W. Bush and John McCain, frankly, and McCain, wanting to continue Bush's policies. So what we're seeing here is a real and genuine movement, and that's, in my opinion, what they're afraid of. And they think they can stop it by promoting Hillary Clinton. I think they're wrong. I think either one of them, Clinton or Obama as the nominee, will continue the movement. I think the movement has, it has begun. I mean, there's just, this is a major sea change in American politics that we're seeing in this election. 57 minutes past the hour.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Well, should we abandon biofuels? We're seeing food riots. Manila, actually, I would say probably a third, maybe a quarter of the entire first section of today's Financial Times was devoted to all the issues around the worldwide food crisis. The Philippines, for example, just tried to buy over 600 million tons of, or 600,000 tons of rice at auction, and they were unable to get a price that they could buy. They're rationing rice, and they're coming out with basically a dole for rice for low-income people. This is happening all over the world. Should we abandon biofuels and put our energy future in ExxonMobil's hands? And Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the T. Boone's Pickens Fellow and Vice President of the Business and Media Institute. Business and Media, andmedia.org is their website. And Dan, I'm guessing you'd say yes.
Well, I'd say at least yes to the first part. I don't think there's really a major advocate for the horrendously failed ethanol policy we have right now. I mean, it's helped raise prices for people here. It's helped raise prices for people abroad, cause one of the causes, and it's not the only cause, but one of the causes for global food crisis, food riots, global instability, and it's just gotten started.
Well, let's look at this radical liberal left-wing publication, Business Week, and their article this month about ethanol, and, in fact, in the current issue. And they point out that the major factors in the rise of food prices around the world are things like the drought in Australia, global warming caused by your buddies over at ExxonMobil throwing more carbon into the air. That, in fact, they say, and I'm quoting from the article, biofuels are a very small factor in rising food prices. Another quote, corn prices have little to do with the increases in rice and wheat, and rice and wheat are not being made into biofuels. And in fact, they say last year, and I'm quoting from Business Week, last year American farmers grew a record 13.1 billion bushels of corn on 85 million acres. Of that, 22% went to make about 7 billion gallons of ethanol. That still left enough corn to supply the domestic market, to increase our exports to record levels, and to stockpile a 10% surplus. Farmers will be able to keep, according to estimates, farmers will be able to keep increasing corn-based ethanol production to 15 billion gallons. That's more than doubling by 2015, a level of output mandated by federal policy, without reducing the amount going for food and feed and without increasing acres planted because of continuing improvements in yields. In other words, no problem here, even though I think you and I probably agree, Dan, that corn, it's stupid for us to be making any kind of fuel, frankly, out of corn, when things like hemp, which produce biodiesel, are so much more effective. You get such a higher yield per acre. Say,
you could start almost anywhere in this discussion. Let's start with that. By everybody's estimation, corn has a bad energy coefficient. It's a bad choice for biofuel.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that, but yes. At the same time, it is not our use of corn for biofuel in the United States that is driving up the price of rice around the world.
Right,
it's global warming that is caused by your buddies at ExxonMobil.
No, it's helping drive up the price, first of all, domestically. We put corn, high fructose corn syrup, in almost everything we eat. So, first of all, it's driving up the price in America. Corn prices have something like doubled in the last couple of years.
All commodity prices have doubled. Oil is pushing $200 a barrel. I mean, it's over $120 a barrel right now. What we're looking at is the devaluation of the U.S. dollar.
That is
again, policies that go back to Ronald Reagan. Dick Cheney's saying, Reagan taught us budget deficits don't matter. Well, they do matter, and they're destroying the dollar. And most of these countries, many of these countries, have currencies pegged to the dollar.
That is part of it. That's another government policy. But ethanol is one of the government policies that's causing a problem. Don't just look at my opinion. I mean, this is a global opinion of some of the chief leaders around the world who are upset that while their countries are starving, we are literally taking food and dumping it into our gas tanks.
But we are exporting more corn than we've ever exported before. And we're not converting any other crops into biofuels, and we're not converting cropland into corn to do this.
We are converting cropland into this. And
not according to Business Week.
At the same time, we're not only dealing with the ethanol problem on this end. You do have crop disruptions, always have. Forget climate change. Climate always changes.
I don't think we can forget climate change right now, Dan. We've got a desert that is moving across Africa. I was in Darfur a couple of weeks ago. I'm telling you, the expansion of the Sahara is one of the things that's driving that crisis. In fact, that would be the first thing that the Sudanese government would tell you. That in Australia, they're having an absolute disaster with the drought. We're looking at wild weather changes here in the United States. You're looking at the loss of glaciers in the Himalayas and in South America in ways that are changing the flow of rivers that are feeding traditional flood deltas that are the places where rice in Asia is grown and in India that are driving up. I mean, we're screwing with the crops because we're screwing with the climate.
But the climate, I mean, see, you're expecting what the... there's a great Mark Twain quote that basically says, climate is what we want, weather is what we get, that it changes. I mean, look, we had an unusually cold winter this past winter. And
Yeah, there's a La Nina cycle going on right now here on the West Coast.
And then the reports come out saying that we may actually have cool weather for the next 10 years.
The El Nino and La Nina cycles go back and forth, but they're small cycles within a much larger cycle that's being driven by the fact that we've almost doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since the 1930s.
But if you go back to the 1930s, things were warmer then. I mean, that's some of the record years for warmth. The Earth's climate...
Not over decades-long periods. You can pull out individual years, but the you and I hope will both agree that the climate is changing in ways that we haven't seen in recorded history.
I don't think anybody knows. I mean, I've read
all of the scientists associated with the UN seem to know.
No, not all the scientists. There's actually
the vast majority of them.
A disagreement among the IPCC, even the people who sign on. It's a collective document. Usually there's a lot of disagreement. But let's get back to ethanol for a second.
Sure.
Because, I mean, I like...
You know, in Brazil, half of the fuel is ethanol, and all of the cars are flex fuel cars. Virtually all of the cars are flex fuel cars.
None of the ethanol is made from corn.
I agree with you that corn is a lousy crop to be using for biofuel.
Okay.
So how do we get Republicans, senators, and members of Congress, to, and Democrats, too, for that matter, a lot of this has been driven by Republicans because a lot of this happened in during the last 10, 15 years when Republicans controlled the House and Senate and we had a Republican president. How do we get the Republicans to stop supporting subsidies for the growth of corn for biofuels?
Let's get both parties.
Both parties. Let's get them to decriminalize hemp. I mean, they're growing hemp like crazy across Canada. They're canola, rapeseed in Germany and in parts of Europe they're looking at. I mean, yes, in some places they're starting to scale this back somewhat and say, we don't want to get too aggressive. We don't want to take too much cropland out of production. But isn't there a role to play for biofuels as a transition as we move toward, moved toward hydrogen and things like that?
I don't have any personal issue against biofuels. I have issue with the ethanol plant. When you have a government mandate for something, which is ethanol, where you take something that may or may not even be, you know, adding anything to our energy policy because it may be a net break even or even a loss, depending on some studies I've seen. You take that, put it in, mandate it. It's just a fiasco. You want to solve the problem? Get the early political primaries out of corn states. Because then if the corn states, if their primaries don't matter as much, then the farm lobby, the corn lobby in Washington is going to have less impact on both Republicans and Democrats.
Although you could argue that if we were to have, you know, crops like hemp and things that actually are quite efficient at producing biodiesel rather than ethanol, that, you know, those farm states, you know, that may well be a good policy. But, you know, I don't actually disagree with you on that, Dan. I'm just concerned that the end game here is let's just go back to oil.
We've got some dramatic
technological improvements in wind and solar to the point where they're competitive with oil now.
If we had an energy policy, we'd actually be pushing every type of energy, in my opinion. I mean, because we're not being allowed to move ahead on a lot of types of energy. It's not just, and the only thing we're moving ahead on is ethanol, which used to have kind of bipartisan support. It had a lot of people on the left who viewed it as an environmental alternative. A lot of people on the right who liked it as a way to placate corn states.
And a lot of people on both sides now are taking a second look at it.
Yeah, and a lot of people in the media.
Maybe there's a concern here.
Years ago, I think it was Katie Couric was talking about it, the wave of the future, this environmentally friendly fuel. Then we find out.
Well, so then we get down to what is the wave of the future? Is it going back to oil or is it going to solar and wind?
I think the wave of the future is a mix. Until we figure out what the future is. Maybe it's hydrogen.
Well, obviously we need a mix for the transitional period. Dan Gaynor, T. Boone's Pickens Fellow and Vice President of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. Dan, thanks for dropping by.
Always a pleasure.
Good talking. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Way back in the year of 2017, the sun was growing hotter and the oil was way beyond its
21 minutes past the hour, and strange stuff going on out there. John Bolton, who has been a guest on this program a couple of times, says that striking Iran, this is from the Telegraph in the UK, John Bolton said that striking Iran would represent a major step toward victory in Iraq. Victory? I thought we already took down Saddam Hussein. I thought we already beat his government. I thought we already took over the country. I thought they had $80 billion in our banks from their oil revenue. Well, apparently Mr. Bolton hasn't been reading the news. While he acknowledged that the risk of a hostile Iranian response harming America's overseas interests existed, gee, no, Sherlock. He said the damage inflicted by Tehran would be far higher if Washington took no action at all. No, I'd say Mr. Bolton is crazy, and we'll just have to leave it at that, because that's, boy, that's incredible. Captain Kirk in our chat room pointing out that this quote from the Indianapolis Star, more voters have turned out in the first half hour than usually turn out in a half day in Indianapolis, Indiana. Republicans appear to be crossing over in droves today in Marion County and suburban counties. Is this the end of the Republican era, or is this Rush Limbaugh's Operation Chaos? We'll find out. Well, or maybe we won't. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see to what extent our media covers this story. So we have the election coming up today. We've got biofuels, a lot on the table. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in New Mexico. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I've got some good news and some bad news and a question for you.
Okay.
What would you? I'll give you the bad news first. I think that we need to pay attention to the fact that the giant agribusinesses like ConAgra and Monsanto are actually price gouging us just as bad as big oil is.
Yes, and in fact, their profits are nearly double right now. It's
a little more than that. Yesterday, yeah. I bought a 25-pound bag of rice in Santa Fe, and it was $52. And I said to the manager, the last one I got was only about $25. And he said, yeah, the price of rice has gone up 70% in the last year.
Yeah.
And then this morning I was reading about the food riots in Mogadishu, yeah, and they said that a bag of rice there costs $52 also.
Right.
Now, we grow a lot of rice in this country, but in the deserts of Somalia, they can't grow any. So right, something's going on.
To what extent does this have to do with the world food supply being dominated by a handful of transnational corporations? I think, frankly, that the cartelization of food, just like we've seen the cartelization of oil, has more to do with these prices than that and the destruction of the dollar by the Bush administration are the two big things driving this, in my opinion.
They're doing two major projects where they take the CO2 from coal-fired electrical plants and pump it into large lakes where algae turn the CO2 and sunlight into a product that can be turned into ethanol. And so,
well, that's interesting. The other great thing that can be used, and Mark, thanks a lot for those. The other great thing that can be used for captured carbon is turning it into something, just turning it into black carbon and putting it back into the soil. And there's a whole process about this. We're going to, get into a whole lot more detail in a subsequent program. But this is a pretty extraordinary thing as well. Dan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dan.
Hi, how are you, Tom? I love your program. I've been listening for a long time. Are you there?
I am.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. The point I wanted to make is that our energy needs in the country are huge. Obviously, they're much larger, I think, than any or all of the energy we can derive.
Well, yes and no, Dan. If we had a 3 mile per gallon increase in the efficiency of cars in the United States, and keep in mind the average European car is about 12 miles per gallon more efficient than American cars, and in China it's mandated to be 10 miles more efficient than American cars. But if we just had a 3 mile per gallon increase in efficiency in the United States, it would equal all the biofuels being produced in the United States.
Well, I think, though, that what we're going to wind up having to do is rely on nuclear power. I just don't think there's any way around that.
The problem with nuclear power is, number one, there's a 30-year known supply of mineable uranium in the world.
number one. So it's as expendable an asset as is oil. And number two, when you take in all of the oil that it takes to find uranium, to mine uranium, to refine uranium, to transport uranium, to build the nuclear power plants, and then to store it afterwards, it ends up being, you know, as Helen Caldicott points out, a nuclear power plant doesn't produce its first a watt of electricity that's purely from uranium until its 13th to 18th year. I mean, nuclear power is not a solution, not the solution. In fact, nuclear power is so bad that if it wasn't for the Price-Anderson Act, if you and I were not paying the insurance bill for the nuclear industry, no company in the world would insure nuclear power plants. Wouldn't happen. They'd be out of business. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
4 minutes past the hour. An Indianapolis area precinct that selected Republican John Elrod. This is in the Indianapolis Star today. They selected Republican John Elrod over Democrat Andre Carson in March's special election for Congress. So, in other words, a Republican district had only 21 voters who requested Republican ballots as of 9 a.m. today out of 168 cast. Amid heavy turnout, Republicans appear to be crossing over in droves in Marion County and suburban counties where fewer Republican voters might impact down-ticket primary races. And then they talk about a couple of examples. One is Megan Ward Bopp, 24. She asked for a Democratic ballot to vote for Barack Obama, but she says she plans to vote for John McCain in November. That's interesting. She says, I'm a hardcore Republican, but it's about who I wanted in second place in case McCain doesn't make it. So she says, I don't like the way this country's been run in the last 20 years. I'm sick of the dynasty of two families that's been running things. So she's actually essentially an Obama supporter, I guess, you know, behind John McCain. On the other hand, Jim Adams, 36, voted for Hillary Clinton to keep the race going beyond Indiana. He's a McCain backer and enjoys watching the Democrats fight. I think in the end, McCain is going to win, Adams said. The Republican strongholds in the counties around Indianapolis have high demand for Democratic ballots, writes the Indianapolis Star. Quoting Barb Stock at Avon United Methodist Church in Hendricks County, she's an election judge. She says, we've seen more Democrats so far in the first few hours than you usually see in a day. Election clerk Clara Pass at the church says, I've had a lot of questions about switching. People want to know if they can switch back and forth, if they can vote Democratic this time, which would be implicitly, and then vote for the Republican in November. So it appears, at least in Indiana, that Limbaugh's Operation Chaos is gaining some traction. Let's keep in mind there's probably not a part of that state where his voice is not heard every day. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And just wrapping up the energy topic here, Michael in Portland. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A longtime listener, and I enjoy your show very much. I look to you as a voice for environmental issues, and in listening to your program, I've never heard you once talk about the livestock industry as a tremendous impact and waste machine.
Oh, we've done several programs on it. If just 10% of Americans were to become vegetarian, it would solve the world food crisis.
Absolutely, and I want your listeners to be very aware of that. Being a vegan and the freedom that gives one to step away from being an impact in a negative way is a big step, but it's just, I never hear it. I would encourage you to maybe even have John Robbins as a speaker or guest on your show.
We've had John Robbins on this program. John's a friend of mine, and he's written some brilliant books on it. His more recent books have not so much been on that. But and also Francis Moore LePay has been on the program a number of times. In fact, we did a show together from Croatia. And from Dubrovnik. So yeah, we've covered the topic. Michael, thanks for the note though, and put a punctuation point on your note. James in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to public broadcasting, and they had a fellow talking about hedge funds. And one of the things that caught my attention was he was mentioning, and this was a couple months ago, that the rice market was going to be. Commodities market, but they were trying to establish it as a commodities market for the first time.
Right.
And the reason they wanted to do this was because consumption of rice was very high, and there was limited reserves, and there's only certain places where it's being grown or can be grown.
Yeah, this is what the Hunt brothers did with silver in Texas back in the 1970s, as I recall, or maybe it was late 60s. I think it was the mid-70s. And, you know, trying to corner the resources, trying to corner the market on a resource to drive its price up so that they can profit from it.
And right, and this sounded very well researched and thought out, and apparently it's actually worked. And, you know, as most people know, rice grows in watery areas, rice paddies, we all know that term, and it can't be grown where corn is grown. So there's no correlation between corn being used for ethanol and the rice prices.
You're right. And in fact, I mean, that was the point that the Business Week article made, was that the use of corn for ethanol in the United States is not, it's not the major variable that's affecting corn prices, and B, it has no effect whatsoever on wheat and rice prices. And as I said, I think that we're seeing the market being manipulated by these giant, agricultural commodity companies. I think that that's what's going on. By the way, happy birthday shout out to Sean Taylor, our producer. Today's her birthday. Happy birthday, Sean. And in fact, let me open your mic and let you say hi. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're welcome. And pleased to have you here, and pleased to have you, make it through another year. Tomorrow will be mine. We'll see what happens. Victor in Orange County. Hey, Victor, you like France's nuclear power program?
It was about 6 months ago in the Marginella section of the of Playboy. There was a gentleman that went over to France, and all of their trains, their high-speed trains, are all run off of nuclear power.
Right.
And they operate their nuclear power plants using weapons-grade nuclear or fissionable material.
Right.
Which I guess when it is spent, it's a lower grade radioactive debris. They store it on the beach near the North Sea in drums in sand. And like he said, he walked across there with a radioactive detector, and there's more radiation in the plane that he flew over there than what he found walking up and down this beach where all of this stored nuclear waste was.
Yeah, France is causing a lot of us to scratch our heads. Is it possible? Have they come across something? On the other hand, France has a long history of nuclear contamination of Pacific islands that they own, and there's a lot of questions about whether these nuclear power plants that France is building and is using, what's going to happen when the containment shells and whatnot become contaminated. How do you decommission them? How do you change them? It may well be that France has come across something that's going to work really great over the short term and be a disaster over the long term, or it may well be that they've using these technologies that they've got something that's actually going to work a little better. I frankly want to learn more about it, Victor, before I offer an opinion on it, and whether the United States should go down that road or not. But again, France, just like here in the United States, at the federal level, they're running these things, and there is not a private company. There are not private companies that would be able to do it with the risks involved. I mean, the massive risks that are involved. And so it's not commercially viable here in the United States. And frankly, I don't think it should or would be anywhere else around the world. Virginia?
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Okay. Hi.
I just want to thank you for not bashing Hillary. I don't.
Well,
mind
you're welcome.
It has to do with her policies. But when it becomes personal about her physical being. It's just not fair.
Oh, I think it goes beyond not fair. I think it harms all of America.
It does.
It's the same thing if, people thinly veiled racist comments about Barack Obama.
Exactly.
It is destructive.
We're all one people.
That's right. Amen. Virginia.
And thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for the call and for your kind words. I mean, this is, well, I've said it. I'm starting to get redundant here and I don't want to do that. Nancy in Oaklawn, Illinois. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. What's up?
Well, your previous caller is not going to like what I have to say because I have to go on record as saying that I've been against Hillary Clinton from the beginning. I never did like her. But besides that, if it was turned around, let me just say this. If it was turned around the other way and Obama was losing, he would have been out of it a long time ago because she would have been at it and at it and at it. And the only reason she deserves what she gets because the only reason, and believe me, I am not for personal attacks and stuff like that. I don't see why Rush Limbaugh is still on the radio. But besides that.
But Nancy, we don't know that that's the case. This is, there's a couple of hundred delegates that are separating.
She would have been added. All her people would have been added.
But that doesn't mean that they would have been successful. There are Obama surrogates who have been calling for Hillary to drop out of the race, too.
Well, she is just, I'm afraid he had it right months ago when he called her Republican light. She's doing everything McCain did in 2000, and that's the reason McCain is winning now. And he stole his soul in 2000.
Yeah. I don't believe Barack Obama has ever referred to Hillary as Republican light. He may have referred to one of her policies that way or one of her suggestions,
but he was right about that. And I'm not defending Obama. I'm telling you, I would have rather have voted for Kucinich or Edwards.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Me too.
I'm saying is there's two things. Hillary said a long time ago, shame on you, Barack Obama. Well, shame on Hillary Clinton. Shame on you, Hillary Clinton.
For
and
what?
The other thing is that one.
For what?
Because she is tearing apart, and I'm not saying it's just her, but this whole procedure, like you said, I agree with you. She's had a terrible campaign. I think she's run a terrible campaign.
Well, in some ways, I disagree with when it's gotten personal, but on the other hand, what we're seeing here is in Oregon, for example. And Nancy, I got to run, but thank you for the comment as we go into this break. We're seeing record registration of Democrats. And now, maybe Limbaugh's hand is very strong in Indiana, but I can tell you here in Oregon, spent part of the weekend with our Secretary of State, we're seeing massive, I think we're seeing a tectonic shift in America's political alignment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
You got to vote 9.5 minutes before the hour. But is messing with our electoral system the appropriate way to do it? I don't think so. Elizabeth in Florida. Hey, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program. Elizabeth?
Hello?
You are on the air. Hello? Okay. No, Elizabeth. Let's see here. Mark in Naples, Florida. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting show today, like always, and I always appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to us on Winds there.
I'm sorry?
Thanks for listening to us on 940 Winds.
Oh, absolutely. It's a breath of fresh air out here. But I wanted to make two important, what I thought were important points. The first is why it's so important to recognize that the youth be appreciated and validated. And what they see in Obama is his approach to topics. He relates to them honestly, whereas Hillary is much more manipulative with the facts and has a political agenda. And I think that's what the parents of people
And
you know, manipulative is another one of those, if I can just interject here, is another one of those words that, you know, like shrill, that is used to characterize somebody as a woman and thus in a sexist context minimize her.
Well, I certainly don't mean it that way, Tom. I just mean to say that she manipulates the facts to suit her agenda, whereas it seems like Brock has more of an allegiance to the objective interpretation of the facts.
I would say with things like, for example, this gas holiday, that he's, you know, he's taking the high road on it, and she's taking the political road on it, and I think that that's a shame, you know, that she's jumping in with John McCain on that. But I'd be very careful of the language. But, Mark, I get your point. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us from Dubai and talkradionews.com.
Yeah, from Dubai. And
hey, Ellen.
It's interesting because a lot of people here are very worried the United States is going to bomb Iran. And we had one source tell us that they think that there's more than two carriers or two large warships in the Gulf. So
is this one of the reasons why the price of oil is so high right now? Is it in anticipation of the loss of the Iranian oil on the market?
Well, I don't know. I think people are pretty nervous, though. But I have to tell you, I was going to start with something else. Actually, I'll start with something else and get to oil in a second.
Okay.
Because this is too good. The House Judiciary voted to subpoena Mr. Addington, David Addington. He's the vice president's chief of staff. And they want him to testify before the committee about what the administration did with interrogation, particularly at Guantanamo, and how he crafted that office crafted the interrogation policies.
Interesting. In other words, are these guys responsible for torture, which is a crime both by United States law and international law?
Exactly. But now I have to, as long as we're talking about gas prices, there was really quite an amazing hearing today, and we actually have some clips, I think, from that and from several clips from the torture hearing this morning, but that on our website. But the representative from Alaska, Donald Young, you know, I think it's two senators and one single representative, said that people are driving like a bunch of idiots and they're driving a million miles an hour. And that was the statement he made on a hearing called Rising Diesel Fuel Costs in the Trucking Industry. And he basically said that America can never drill its way into total independence, but we can drill our way into more stability. And he also said he had a solution to make people change the driving habit. He's going to promote a tax of $1 on every gallon of gasoline.
Well, we're importing 60% of our oil right now, so there's no way to drill our way into anything. I mean, there's no way that we can replace 60% of our oil with domestic supplies, no matter how large they are. And B, as wacky as that sounds and as totally politically inappropriate as it is, the reality is that in the UK, they're spending more than $10 a gallon for gasoline. In Germany, they're spending about $9 a gallon for gasoline. It's been that way, particularly when you adjust dollars to their currency, you know, because our dollars have been so inflated. I mean, 20 years ago when I lived in Germany, gas was $5 a gallon. And the people are not complaining. What they're doing is they're buying cars that could get a better gas mileage.
Well, yeah, I mean, for sure, that's true. But it is true that people also have a huge appetite for gas in this country. A couple other interesting things. Steny Hoyer had a pen and pencil this morning. He held up a big sign, and he said that the Bush growth was 4% over from January 2001 or over since then, and that payrolls grew by 20% during the Clinton administration, and that he was talking about payroll growth.
Right.
And he said that job losses in the last 2 months have increased mortgage foreclosures, and that housing inventory has gone way up. And he said that in terms of gas prices, the House voted on possible solutions, but the Republicans have voted against him. He said their only solution has been to drill for more oil and in places that won't produce much. So oil was the big issue. And then he was asked about circumventing committees on the budget and going to the floor. And he said, let me tell you about circumventing. The 02 omnibus, 10 bills. 03 omnibus, 8 bills. 04 omnibus, 7 bills. Similar in 05, 06, 07, all brought to the floor without going through committees. When I hear Republicans and their crocodile tears about circumventing and think that they, that about the vote they left open for 3 hours, I am not greatly moved to empathy with their position.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure.
A few other things today. There was this hearing on Guantanamo Bay. Jerry Nadler from New York led a discussion about what the law says, what torture is, and finally came out and said that torture is un-American and yet it's been used by this government against those in custody and our control. So he was pretty verbal about that as well.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh gosh, there's just so much.
We're just about out of time, Ellen. I'm just curious. You're there in the Middle East. Is the word on the street that the U.S. is going to attack Iran? Is that what the average person is thinking?
Yeah, that is what the average person thinks.
Wow. Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, calling in from Dubai. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Coming up next, what the Pentagon pundits were selling on the side.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, the corporate media, welcome back to the program, by the way, the corporate media is still not talking about this bombshell that a couple of weeks ago was dropped by the New York Times, that all these military analysts who were hyping the war in Iraq before the war, during the war, after the war, right up until a couple of weeks ago on all the network programs, we're actually making out very well on the side, thank you very much, in a whole variety of ways. The depth and breadth of it is just now starting to come into clear view. John Stauber is with us. John is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, prwatch.org, their website. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
This story that Diane Farsetta wrote from the Center for Media and Democracy over at Alternet gets into a lot of the details of this. I know you're very, very familiar with this topic, and there's just so much content here. I wanted to drill into it a little deeper with somebody who has done the work and done the research. But before I get into this, I'm just curious your take on the early reports that we're getting out of Indiana that there's, particularly in largely Republican areas, massive crossover voting. Is this, do you think, Limbaugh's Operation Chaos, or is this people saying, I've had it with Bush and McCain?
Well, I guess we won't know until the pollsters get at this later tonight. But clearly, partisans from either party can enjoy voting in the other's primary and sort of messing things up.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see, much like with the Pentagon scandal, it's going to be interesting to see to what extent the corporate media covers, you know, the Limbaugh involvement in it. It seems to have been a very uncovered story up to this point, but or maybe it's appropriately dismissed. In any case, the Pentagon launched its covert media analyst program in 2002. So this was as the whole Afghanistan thing was going on and going into Iraq, and they didn't just use it to sell the war. They also used it to whitewash Guantanamo Bay, to whitewash torture, to whitewash rendition, and to defend warrantless wiretapping. And now tell us what we know about the people who are involved in this.
Well, first of all, just to emphasize what you said at the start of the interview, this Pentagon military analyst program is illegal propaganda. We're only aware of it because of a tremendous long investigative piece by David Barstow that appeared in the New York Times 2 weeks ago Sunday. And what we now know, thanks to Barstow and the lawyers at the New York Times forcing these documents out of the Pentagon, is that in 2002, Donald Rumsfeld and Tory Clark, the minister of propaganda there at the Pentagon, recruited 75 or more military analysts to be their propaganda team and embedded them inside the TV networks as analysts. Of course, the networks are tripping over themselves to hire these retired military officers as analysts. So it was pretty easy for the Pentagon to get these people into the networks. The networks wanted to pay them. What Barstow reported in his piece is that the overwhelming majority of these 75 military analysts who were working as propagandists, message surrogates is one of the labels used internally in the Department of Defense documents. These guys almost all had personal business that they were conducting either as registered lobbyists or in most cases as highly paid consultants and members of firms that were working for companies profiting off the war by selling right. all sorts of military equipment and services. And Diane Farsetta, my colleague, in her article, What the Pentagon Pundits Were Selling on the Side, Propaganda Meets Corporate Lobbying, took a closer look at some of the actual business ties of some of these individuals. Now, just to mention, this scandal has two important parts. One, of course, is the media scandal that many of us have been flagging for years of the corporate media turning to people with a vested interest in promoting and profiting from war, former military officers, as color commentators and online analysts.
Right.
But
it goes way beyond just the $500 to $1,000 that is typically paid to one of these folks to
exactly.
come on. I mean, whenever you hear on a particularly on a cable network, but really on any of the networks, whenever you hear somebody introduced as a MSNBC commentator or an ABC analyst, or whenever they have a title that has the network's name attached to it, that means that they're being paid. That's kind of code for this person's in our employ, and they're being paid for each one of their appearances, typically $500 to $1,000 per appearance, although there are some people who can command a whole lot more than that. But that's chicken feed. That's nothing compared to what these guys were making on the side.
Yeah, on the side, they're making and their firms are making, in some cases, you know, millions and millions of dollars for the firms, the big military contracting companies.
In some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, you know, this war is ultimately going to wind up costing probably $3 trillion when all is said and done, and a lot of that money ends up in the companies that in the hands of the companies that these gentlemen work for and
yeah.
work for.
And this is something that is just so fundamentally, absolutely fundamentally un-American. I believe that this is a clip of Franklin Roosevelt talking about this.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad.
Talking about World War II.
The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
And yet that was his fireside chat from May of 1940. And yet that is happening right now in the United States. And there seems to be no uproar about it. The networks, the television networks are not even mentioning this.
They're censoring it out. And of course, most Americans, unfortunately, get most of their news and information and their propaganda by watching television. Most Americans sit down, watch television, and that's what informs them. So for the TV networks who were complicit in this illegal Pentagon propaganda and who completely violated the most fundamental tenets of journalism and reporting by hiring these military analysts with known conflicts of interest to now refuse to report on this is just a slap in the face. And it's a really frightening situation. Most Americans don't read the New York Times. Most Americans don't listen to this radio show. Most Americans get most of their news from the networks who are in bed with this propaganda program, who really just echoed over and over the Bush propaganda that led us into this war, and they're refusing to even admit
Howie Kurtz says they're not talking about it. Howie Kurtz of CNN says they're not talking about it because they're embarrassed. Might it be that they are not talking about it because it would be not just an admission of dropping the public trust, but of criminal activity? And what can we do about this? We're talking with John Stauber, PRWatch.org, his website.
Well, I think saying that they're embarrassed really makes light of it. You would hope that some people in CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, CNN, MSNBC have some modicum of journalistic integrity and do feel embarrassment. But this is a huge corporate scandal, the way these media companies were duped. And I think they're not talking about it because they are the media, and if they ignore it, most people will never hear about it and never feel the outrage.
Well, there's also these interlocking boards of directors. If you go over to theyrule.net, you can connect, you know, members of the boards of directors of virtually any of the media companies. Sometimes it takes one or two hops through different companies to virtually all of the major defense contractors. I mean, it's really quite startling how incestuous this whole industry is, the whole military industrial media complex. I mean, we've added media to Dwight Eisenhower's military industrial complex.
Well, we really have. And, you know, Sheldon Rampton and I in Weapons of Mass Deception, which came out almost 5 years ago now,
pointed
out how the TV networks were profiting off the war by hyping the heck out of it, building huge audiences. And that, in fact, is a new type of media war profiteering.
Yeah. Is this a crime?
Yeah, it is a crime. This is illegal propaganda. There has been the beginnings of a congressional effort to investigate, and we have to keep lighting the fire.
Good. Okay, so call your congressman and say, we want some investigations into this. You can go to callcongress.org for those phone numbers. John Stauber, PRWatch.org, the website. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. And George W. Bush, sometime back, had this to say about wiretapping and warrants.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. It's important for our fellow citizens to understand, when you think Patriot Act, constitutional guarantees are in place when it comes to doing what is necessary to protect our homeland, because we value the Constitution.
So Carolyn Fredrickson is the director of the ACLU Washington Legislative Office, ACLU.org, the website. I am a proud card-carrying member of the ACLU.
That's wonderful.
And Caroline?
Caroline,
thank you. I'm sorry. Bush was lying through his teeth, wasn't he?
He sure seemed to be, yeah. I mean, well, unless he just wasn't in the loop. But yeah, I mean, it makes me laugh almost now to hear that, because unfortunately, I think it's a clip that should be played over and over, if only to remind members of Congress that there was a time when they were actually angry about the president for violating the law. They were angry that he had been wiretapping without a warrant, that he'd been violating our constitutional protections that are embodied in the Fourth Amendment. There was a time they were angry about all that. And now, it seems that they are doing their best to make a deal with the least popular president in history.
You know, when you consider that, for example, Vince Foster, a depressed member of the Clinton staff, you know, goes out and commits suicide, and the right-wingers turn this into a well, to this day, they're still claiming that Hillary somehow murdered this guy. I mean, it's how bizarre it gets. Can you imagine if Bill Clinton was president and had been illegally wiretapping people, the Republicans would be going, oh, he was listening in on us. You know, this is political wiretapping. He was listening to our strategy set. You know, I mean, they would turn this into a conspiracy, and probably the press would pick it up, and probably most Americans would even start to believe it.
Absolutely. Well, let's just remember Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah,
I mean,
and let's remember Richard Nixon, because when Richard Nixon was illegally wiretapping without a warrant, he actually was wiretapping the Democrats.
So how
do we know that George Bush wasn't? And why are no Democrats mentioning this? And why is it now that we have Jay Rockefeller, a Democrat, who is saying, well, let's give the telecoms immunity so that there won't be any problem? I don't get it. Why is Congress even considering going along with Bush on this?
Well, you know, it's the basic question, and it's one I'm having a really hard time answering. You know, unfortunately, I think that the only answer I can come up with is that they're so craven and so scared of doing anything that might at all damage their chances in November that they are going to capitulate on issues that they categorize as national security. And I think
you're saying the Democrats. Jay Rockefeller is not up for re-election this year, is he?
Well, the Democratic Party as a whole has been beaten and beaten and beaten over the head by the Republicans and called soft on terrorism, just like they used to say soft on crime. And it appears that the Democrats now seem to share that opinion, that if they do their best to protect our Constitution at the same time they're keeping us safe, that somehow that's not doing the right thing.
It sounds like you're describing something halfway between Stockholm Syndrome and battered wife syndrome.
You're exactly right. That's what it is. It's inside the Beltway syndrome.
And yet in the House of Representatives, while the Senate voted to give Bush what he wanted, the Democrats in the Senate caved in, the Democrats in the House of Representatives drew the line in the sand. Are they going to do it again?
Well, yes, and just to remind your listeners, you know, there was a terrible bill passed last August that the president helped jam through. It expired in February. The Senate passed a really terrible bill that gives the president all he wants and more, practically. And the House passed a very different bill that does not provide immunity for the telecom companies that helped Bush break the law and keeps some oversight for the courts on the surveillance under the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, there's a distinction there. But what we're really worried about right now is that there is an effort, a backroom deal is underway between House leadership, Rockefeller, and the White House. It's a scary combination. And we're trying to sound the alarm for people to contact their members of Congress and say, do not give immunity to those telecom companies.
Right. By America, House leadership, are you talking about Nancy Pelosi?
Well, you know, it's more Mr. Hoyer.
Steny Hoyer. Yeah.
Leading the negotiations.
So so you can go to callcongress.org. It's just a page on our website that has toll-free numbers for the switchboard in Congress. I'm sure ACLU.org, you probably have ways to access.
We have
an
action up there. And I guess what I just tell people is that I think they need to, you know, remind the leadership of Congress, particularly the House leadership, that they allowed the Protect America Act to expire in February, and their constituents applauded. Their constituents did not demand that they all of a sudden
roll because this act did not protect America. It spit on the Constitution.
It absolutely did. And, you know, when we look around the world and think that, you know, somehow we are supposed to be the model of the country that has a robust democracy and a strong constitution, we're certainly doing a great deal of damage to that image.
Absolutely. So it's time now for people to, right now, here's your action item for the day. Call your member of the House of Representatives and call both of your senators. You can find information at ACLU.org. There's also ways to directly contact them through ACLU.org, as well as callcongress.org. And let them know, no immunity for the telecom companies and implicitly this administration. Caroline Fredrickson, thank you so much for being
here. Oh, well, it was a pleasure.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Well, this is a very, very interesting story. It kind of came out of nowhere. I don't know the context of it. I don't think any of us do. This a Reuters story, Dateline Lagos, Nigeria. And keep in mind, Nigeria, the Niger Delta is where most of the oil comes from. Royal Dutch Shell, it was in Nigeria that Ken was a Sawahira. I'm sorry, I don't remember his last name, but he was hung by the government some years back, and Shell later apologized for any complicity in that. And there has been a long history of people in the Niger Delta standing up to the oil companies and saying, you know, no, you're destroying our land, you're taking the oil, you're taking our wealth, you're taking our money, and none of it is coming down to the people. And so there's this organization called MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. And they have claimed responsibility for 5 attacks on oil facilities since April, when they resumed this basically violent campaign against Royal Dutch Shell. They've shut down 164,000 barrels of oil a day. And they made an announcement today that, well, here's the quote. The MEND command is seriously considering a temporary ceasefire appeal by Senator Barack Obama. Obama is someone we respect and hold in high esteem. So is Barack Obama playing the role of a senior statesman already as a presidential candidate? If so, he's apparently doing it very quietly in the background and doing it in a way that will reduce the level of violence in the world. I mean, if that's the case, what an extraordinary thing. What an absolutely extraordinary thing. So we'll keep an eye on this and keep you up to date on it. Jeff in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey,
hi,
Jeff,
Tom.
What's up?
I just wanted to comment on your interview earlier where the person was saying that he believes that the media networks may be embarrassed. That was why they won't cover it. And
yeah, that's what Howie Kurtz of CNN said.
Yeah, I really couldn't disagree with that more. HBO made a movie about this called Live from Baghdad, starring Michael Keaton. And in the movie, they play actual footage from the first Gulf War, where it was just Peter Arnett, basically, and his crew in downtown Baghdad. No other networks had feeds out, so every network used that feed out. And they have the quote, Tom Brokaw saying, you know, we all thought CNN was the little guy. We certainly don't see them as the little guy any longer. To that effect,
right.
I don't have it exactly correct.
Yeah.
But we don't see CNN as the little guy anymore. Unless you had been a fan of Braves baseball prior to that, you didn't know who CNN was. Now we all know who CNN is solely because of that war.
Well, and
they,
you know, there are a number of careers that were made by that. You know, Wolf Blitzer, for example, you know, made his career. There's a number of people who have had.
They want war more than W wants war himself. They make more money in this atmosphere than any atmosphere. They want to elongate the campaign cycles to make more money off of the political season, but that only comes around during election time. They fall back to the war, and they've all made a ton of money off this. They're not embarrassed. They may be afraid of not being able to get the next interview if they don't portray the book.
I think they're afraid, Jeff, of being prosecuted. These are, you know, they hired these guys. These guys were violating the Hatch Act, among other things. And
how many things have they been caught red-handed with, though, Tom? How many?
But the media?
Catch them.
I don't think that they're. I think this is the first time that the media in the United. I mean, you know, the Bush administration. We can give them a long list. Obviously, the Bush administration, you know, doesn't want to be prosecuted also, but they feel that they're pretty immune to this. But I don't. I think that these media companies are.
In New York, New York Times reporter.
Say it again, Jeff. What did I miss?
Been skirting the edges of legality at all. This isn't the first time at all. They were willing participants in a propaganda war against the people of the United States. No immunity for telecom communication companies, and no immunity for these networks that went out and broke the law. And oh, by the way, this is a time of war. These are absolutely war criminals, and they need to be held accountable. These people need to have their lives put on the line, put to death if found to be guilty for the plus 4,000 American soldiers dead and the countless civilians, millions of people, not just displaced, hundreds of thousands dead human beings. Yeah. They need to be held accountable, and the CEOs.
Jeff, no,
need to
Jeff,
know
got
about
it, and you said it very well, and now you're starting to get redundant, and I am in agreement, by and large, with your point. And this, I mean, this is the thing: the these media companies are not willing to talk about this because they may well have violated laws, and they certainly have violated the, you know, the fundamentals of decency and morality here in the United States. Yeah. Stan in Seattle. Hey, Stan.
Hello?
Stan, you're on the air.
Yes. Tom, I'm kind of surprised you're surprised that they'd have the generals doing that after Judy Miller and all the rest of them.
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. What I'm surprised, actually, I'm not surprised by any of it. What I'm surprised is that there hasn't been more of a more outrage coming out of Congress. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you would expect Henry Waxman at the very least and Pat Leahy and others to be just, you know, crawling all over. And,
I was going
to
help
and,
you.
And there's a relationship, there's an unfortunate symbiotic relationship between elected members of at the federal level of Congress and the press. And that's a toxic relationship as well. And I think that may have something to do with why we're not seeing investigations of this.
Look, I was going to help you out with two things. I'm an old farm boy, and I had an uncle that had a still out and back, and he used corn squeezins to make his stuff with, and then he would feed them to the cattle and the hogs.
Right.
When you make ethanol, that corn goes from the field to the ethanol plant. They produce ethanol. Then they take what's left, the corn squeezins or the mash.
Basically the cellulose.
And they sell it to farmers for cattle feed and hog feed and chicken feed.
Yep.
So it's not wasted. It's not as if it's taken out and burned and stuff. So it's the same amount going there.
Right.
The other thing, the rice thing, I think it was Bill Moyer's journal the last couple of weeks, had a thing about Texas rice land going completely fallow, no rice being grown at all. Because Bush had set up with the Republican Congress some kind of a deal where they would get paid more money not to produce rice than to produce rice.
Yeah.
And this was the guys that owned the land. They had farmers wanting to farm their land again that they rented, and they couldn't. And I forgot how many hundreds of thousands of acres of rice land was taken out. And the higher the price of rice goes, the more these people who own the land get paid not to rent the land out.
No, I got it, Stan, and agree with you. And this is, I mean, I grew up in Michigan in the center of farmland. I mean, all around me was farmland, and a lot of my friends were either related to, I mean, almost everybody would go, had some, you know, cousin someplace who was on a farm within 15, 20 miles, 30 miles of Lansing. I mean, we were surrounded by farmland. In fact, there was farmland. We lived in the southern end of Lansing. There was farmland started about six city blocks from my house. And these were mostly small farms, 40, 60, 80, 100 acres, 200 acres, small farms. And a lot of those people I've kept in touch with over the years, and almost without exception, particularly during the 80s and 90s when it got really bad and Willie Nelson was out there doing Farm Aid, these people were having to sell their farms. And who was buying them? The big three and four agribiz companies, Cargill, ADM, and their front companies were buying up the farms and then hiring the people who for generations had been farmers on those lands to basically be tenant farmers. And that's what we have across the United States now. So we've got a bunch of people who are now employees on the land that they used to own. And a lot of this is made possible by weird farm subsidy laws that benefit large multinational and transnational corporations and screw the average farmer. It's just ongoing process. Elizabeth in Florida, listening on Winds. Hey, Elizabeth.
Tom, hi.
Yes, hi.
I finally got through. I'm back.
I beg your pardon?
Got through. I called earlier, but you disconnected me or someone did.
Okay, what's up?
I just want to say I'm a big fan of your show because you're one of the few people who actually go and talk about the issues. Everyone else is carrying on with the banter, with the rock.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. You know, lest you think you're going to be cut off again, we have about a minute before the break. What's the point you wanted to make?
No, I just want to hear less Barack, Hillary fodder, and more McCain bashing. I mean, we're talking about a guy who got on television and did a photo op in front of the Navy and civilians and everything. And just before that, he had said no to a bill that was going to give more money to VA funding.
Yeah, John McCain is opposed to the new GI Bill. He talks about Hurricane Katrina. This was so bizarre. Last week, John McCain was, in a soft way, criticizing the Bush administration for Katrina, saying that if he was president when Katrina happened, he would have been down in the nearest Air Force base the next day. Well, it turns out the next day, George W. Bush was in Arizona eating birthday cake with John McCain, who is in the United States Senate, who could have just as easily has said, hey, I'm a U.S. senator. I represent, in many ways, all of the people of the United States as much as Arizona. I'm going to get on a plane and get out of Hurricane Katrina. And he didn't. You're absolutely right, Elizabeth. We need to be talking more about John McCain right across the board. More about John McCain and his, shall we say, shortcomings and flip-flops. And less about attacking our own candidates. The circular firing squad has to come to an end. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Program, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270. David in Montana, listening at 9:30 a.m. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just want to say I appreciate all you do for our democracy. Isn't it convenient that the biofuels are being blamed for the rise in food prices, when in reality we all know that the cost of petroleum is having a huge effect on things? It's just a kind of a double win for the petroleum companies. But that's actually not why I called it. I just wanted to reiterate.
And Cargill and ADM and several of these other companies just announced record profits in the last quarter. I mean, you know, it's right across the board. Everybody's making out like a bandit in this thing. Anyhow,
they're getting a lot of bang for their buck out of this.
Yeah.
But the reason I called, actually, though, was to mention that a previous caller talked about Hillary Clinton's association with Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. And I question whether you're doing a real service for your listeners not really exploring this a little bit further. I mean, Murdoch has done fundraisers for her. There's been this huge love fest of the Fox propagandists. And then just recently, during the Pennsylvania primary, she met with Pittsburgh billionaire Richard Mellon Scafee.
Who launched
a written endorsement.
Yeah,
I just want to ask a question. Can you explain the difference between neoconservative and neoliberal?
Yes. Well, first of all, with regard to Hillary Clinton, we've covered all those issues on this program, and they raise a lot of red flags for me, and I'm very concerned about it. And to the best of my knowledge, you know, there's no response from the Clinton camp other than they'll take whatever support they can get wherever they'll get it, which I suppose in the political world has some validity, although if I was running a campaign, I wouldn't do it that way. With regard to the difference between neoconservative and neoliberal, neoliberalism is generally regarded as it's a phrase that's very popular in Europe and most of the rest of the world, frankly, and it's the definition of what in the United States you might call libertarianism, absolute free trade. You know, libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. At least the economic policies of the libertarians, of turn it all over to the multinational corporations, no more national boundaries, absolute free trade, the government involved at a very, very minimal, if at all, level in social policy and social benefits, and the government's only purpose being basically to maintain a military and police and prisons. That is neoliberalism, and you find its roots in the writings of Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman, and more recently, Tom Friedman. Neoconservatives are people who, in many cases, started out as kind of lefty radicals back in the 60s, who became hardcore right-wing radicals out of this weird notion that was advanced by Leo Strauss and others, that because no two democracies have ever gone to war with each other, it's important to spread democracy across the world, regardless of the cost and regardless of the technique, that somehow the ends absolutely justifies the means, that it's okay to even lie to people if ultimately it's in their best interest, and therefore shoving democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun is the highest and most noble thing that we can do. and the neoconservatives, you know, Bill Kristol and all the people associated with Dick Cheney in this administration, I think have been roundly discredited. But the neoconservatism worldview and perspective has more to do with foreign policy and democracy. And the neoliberal worldview claims that there's an association between democracy and what I would refer to as conservative economic policies, although the rest of the world refers to it as neoliberal. It's an interesting collection of confusing terms. Mary in Palo Alto, California, listening on Green 960.
Hey,
Mary.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Hi. Actually, I was wanted to comment about how you were talking about CNBC and the media and the terrible bias they have. And last night, it really infuriated me. I was watching PBS, and they had the American Experience on, and they were featuring a story on George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41.
Right.
And it was a total puff piece, a piece of propaganda. There were virtually no critics at all of Bush on the show.
Right.
There was no criticism whatsoever.
Well, you know, the board of directors of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is controlled by Republicans. It's their political appointees.
Well, I mean, this program is being sent out to schools, but at least I would hope that we could have a balanced piece from public television.
Yeah, it's a hope, frankly, Mary, that I has long gone. I mean, ever since, you know, what was it, 15 years ago, maybe longer, that ADM was outed by PBS, by the radio division, for price fixing, and they I think they had to pay a $300 million fine. And now you've got advertising on public broadcasting that is, you know, just as blatant and just as obvious and just as much advertising as it is on commercial radio. And I believe that it's influencing their content dramatically. Plus, as I said, the board of directors of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which owns, you know, this kind of programming, is controlled by Republicans. I'm increasingly referring to it as National Republican Radio and National Republican Broadcasting. David, and thank you for the call, though, and pointing that out. David in Santa, and it is outrageous to do fluff pieces on David in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
My question is around the trade of gold. Apparently there's something called the Trading with the Enemies Act,
right.
1917.
Yep.
Says the president can suspend the sale of gold. Is that?
Yeah, and Roosevelt did it. Uh-huh. Although Roosevelt did it during the Great Depression, he did it before the war, as I recall.
Is that something that would concern us in today's time, or?
I don't think so. I think the Trading with the Enemies Act, arguably you could apply it, depending on how you define enemies, as far as I know, the only major nation in the world that has nuclear weapons that has had a senior government official threaten to nuke U.S. cities and has not officially withdrawn that threat is China. And so you could argue that Walmart is guilty of trading with the enemy. I don't know. Some would argue it's a stretch, but interesting question. Tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey is going to drop by to talk about what the outcome of today's primaries means for the candidates. We'll get the Republican perspective on it. Of course, we'll be getting your perspective on it. And Barry Reid joins me to tell us how to disappear in America. Yes, it's legal. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.